We're in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation. We invite your attention to the 17th chapter. We have noted a number of times that the 1st through the 11th chapters constitute a section of this book. And by the time you come to the conclusion of the 11th chapter, we note the conclusion of what has happened among God's people and the victory that we see at the latter part of the 11th chapter. But we don't know the why. Beginning in chapter 12, we read about the why. And we note that there is a battle, if you please, between good and evil, between God and Satan, that manifests itself in that chapter going forward. We see that then play out as far as the characters are concerned with world empires. Now somebody said, well, the book of Revelation is about the second coming of the Lord and all kinds of people like Russia and China and they've got it all nailed out as to who's going to be doing what at the second coming of the Lord. No, John is writing about things which must shortly come to pass. And he's told the saints in Asia Minor, those to whom this epistle is addressed, as it is addressed to the seven churches of Asia Minor. You see that in chapter 1, verse 11. Understanding that, you'll notice the seven letters that are addressed to the seven churches of Asia Minor in chapters 2 and 3. And then in chapters 4 and 5, we see a panoramic vision of the throne room of God. And in the throne room of God, you see the four living creatures and the 24 elders bowing down and giving homage unto God. And then in the 5th chapter, you see those 24 elders and the four living creatures bowing down before the Lamb and giving praise and honor to the Lamb of God for the great things that He has achieved for us. And then at the conclusion of the 5th chapter, you read about these bowing down before the Father and the Son, giving praise unto them both. Now, in verse 1 of chapter 6, we see the Lamb beginning to open the seals that have been described in the early part of the fifth chapter. And with the opening of these seals, we see judgment, essentially, of God. In the 7th chapter, we've noted that there was a restriction, as it were, placed upon the judgment of God until the saints could be sealed. Now, we've talked about the 140 and 4,000. And the 144,000 is not a literal number, but a complete number to indicate those who belonged unto God. Now, as we continued into the 8th chapter, we resume the opening of the seals with the opening of the 7th seal. And several things that we noted in the 8th chapter, even in more recent studies, as we saw some parallels in the 8th chapter of what we're seeing and studying now in the 17th chapter. And one of the things that we have tried to note is that in the book of Revelation, you see overlays. Now, some of you who are older, remember that when I preached, I used overhead projection transparencies. Now, some of you don't even have an idea what that is. I'm confident about that. But one of the things that was an advantage about the overhead transparencies is you could do the overlays. You could lay one chart down and you could put another chart right over the top of it that showed more detail of the previous charts. And you could continue to build the transparencies on that kind of a slideshow presentation. Now, I know you can do that with PowerPoint. Somebody probably just said that back here. See, I can't see your mouths move, so I don't read lips anymore. But the point being is that was very helpful with the transparencies. And that's what we're seeing in the book of Revelation. We're seeing somewhat of an overlay presentation of this great battle and great victory between good and evil and how that ultimately Christ and His church always wins. Now, if you get that through the study of the book of Revelation, and my judgment, you've got the gist of the book. So don't be bogged down and think that I can't read and study and learn from the book of Revelation. I believe that you can. Now, beginning in the 9th chapter, We see the sounding of the fifth angel and so forth, and these were judgments of God. But beginning in the 10th chapter, we noted the revelation of what is called a mystery. And I think that when we get to the 10th chapter of the book of Revelation, we're compelled to look at some Old Testament texts such as the book of Daniel, chapter 7. And Daniel chapter 7 has been a hinge pin of the things that we've tried to discuss from the book of Revelation, because Daniel in chapter 2 and chapter 4 and in chapter 7 is emphasizing that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And in Daniel chapter 2, speaking with King Nebuchadnezzar, we find that Daniel is telling Nebuchadnezzar of the course of world empires, beginning, he said, with you. So we know where that starts. That starts with the Babylonian Empire ruled over by King Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel is very pointedly telling Nebuchadnezzar, your kingdom will not last. There will be one that will overthrow it. There will be another that will overthrow that one. And there will be another that will overthrow that one. And in the days of the fourth empire, God will set up one that will never be overthrown. Never. Now that becomes quite significant. Daniel is not telling King Nebuchadnezzar about what God's going to do at the second coming of the Lord. He's not telling King Nebuchadnezzar about the establishment of some kind of an earthly empire. But Daniel is telling King Nebuchadnezzar what he's going to do, what God is going to do during the reign of those Roman kings. That's the sequence of kingdoms that Daniel has outlined. Now somebody said, preacher, how do you know that? Well, you can read that in Bible history. And you can also read that in world history. The only exception to the history that's recorded in the Bible is the Greek or Alexandrian kingdom that occurred during the intertestamental period. But Daniel identified it. He didn't call it that. He didn't give us the years when it would start and when it would end, but he did identify it. And strangely enough, you begin reading in your New Testament, and who is in power? The fourth kingdom, the Roman kings. Now you can read that in your New Testament and know that the things that Daniel was telling King Nebuchadnezzar about were indeed coming to pass on God's timeline. Now another interesting thing that we want to note relative to that is Daniel did not only tell King Nebuchadnezzar when God would set up his kingdom during the days of the kings of this fourth empire, but he also told Nebuchadnezzar that during the days of that fourth world empire that it too would end. And that's what you read in Daniel chapter 7. The empires of man are not intended to last forever. Take that to heart. World empires are never intended to last forever. God used them, He had a purpose for them, and then they ended. But during the days of the Roman kings, we find that there was intense persecution against those who were Christians. And it would seem that Satan could, through the use of the Roman entity, stamp out the infant church and destroy it. Now keep in mind the efforts all along to stop that from happening. You go back to the Garden of Eden, come forward. You see the efforts of Satan to stop the plan of God. And when you read of the crucifixion of Jesus, you can say, well, Satan and his angels were at a day of rejoicing. But Jesus was raised from the dead, didn't stop that either. And Jesus himself had said, upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. Not anything Satan can do to stop it. So then we see in the 12th chapter that the attention has been turned from the production of the plan, the preparation for the plan, to those who are a part of the Lord's church. And we see that all of those souls who have been martyred for the cause of Christ have been crying out from chapter 6, from under the altar, beginning in verse 9, that their cause be vindicated. Now, beginning in chapter 12, we see that that's surely to come to pass. Now, I'm not, when I say that should come to pass, don't misunderstand. I'm not talking about something that's yet future in our days. But the oppression that was caused by Rome to try to stamp Christianity, and I don't like to use that term, but I use it accommodatively, completely out of existence. fail. Rome failed. And Rome fell, just as God said to Daniel that it would. Now, as we look at the 13th and 14th chapters, we see that stated emphatically. You see Rome described as the beast that came out of the sea, chapter 13, the first few verses. And when you get to the 11th verse of the 13th chapter, you read of another beast that came up out of the earth. That's very significant to us because the beast that came up out of the sea was empowered by the dragon, Satan, identified in chapter 12, verse 9. And you'll note in chapter 13 that the sea beast that came was authorized by the dragon, that is, by Satan, to do what? He was authorized to punish the people of God. And then in the 11th verse, you'll read about the beast that came up out of the earth, and he's authorized by the sea beast, who was authorized by the dragon, by the devil, to persecute anyone who should not worship the image of the beast, even to the extent that he should be killed, verse 15. Now that tells you that Roman emperor worship was real. It tells you that Roman emperor worship was enforced, even to the extent of killing those who would not worship the beast or his image. Now, why is that important to us, brethren? Why was it important to them? You see, because the groundwork had been laid to accept pagan worship. Now, if you believe that it's all right to worship any and everything, what difference does it make to you to have an idol over here of the emperor and worship him too? For after all, you would just have to do that once a year, as was required by Rome, to acknowledge the emperor as God and burn incense as an act of worship to the emperor. Now, you might say, well, I could do that. No, you could not. Not as a Christian, not and be faithful to the Lord. You could not do that, not even once. But if you have accepted the pagan idolatrous package, you could do that, couldn't you? That wouldn't be a problem to you. But as a Christian, you could not do that. Now, what's that going to mean to you? If you'll back to verse 12, or chapter 12, verse 10, it says, I heard a great voice in heaven saying, now has come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God, the authority of His Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, who accuseth them before our God day and night, and they overcome him because of the blood of the Lamb, and because of the word of their testimony, and they loved not their life even unto death. Now, Mr. Roman Emperor or Mr. Satan, how do you overcome that? And you say, well, you can't. And you're right. People that are willing to die rather than to deny who Jesus is. People who are willing to die rather than to burn one little pinch of incense unto the emperor can't do that. And when you bring that thought on then into the 15th, 16th, and in particular into the 17th and 18th chapters, which we're studying this morning, almost said afternoon, which we're studying this morning, you see the imagery become more complete. In the 17th chapter, we read about a scarlet woman riding upon a scarlet beast. Now, keep in mind, I know this is our first Sunday morning to come back in this format to study from this. But we're picking up where we left off last Sunday evening or afternoon at 5 o'clock, to be precise. So we're in the middle of the 17th chapter, and we're talking about this character that's identified as Babylon the Great, the mother of the harlots and of the abomination of the earth, there in verse 5. Now, what's to happen to this Babylon? In previous studies, and you've joined us, you know what we're talking about. We've seen how that the term Babylon and how that the term harlot is used in Scripture. We've seen how that Rome is not the only one that is called Babylon or Babylon the Great. We talked about the city of Tyre being a harlot. We've talked about the city of Nineveh And we've talked about the kingdom, or the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. And we've even talked about the city of Jerusalem. And we noted that this terminology used in the context of the symbolic language of the Old Testament, now in the book of Revelation, is helpful to us to understand that he's identifying those who have rebelled against God, those who have imposed idolatrous worship, and those who have endorsed those things that are related to that, as we've talked about the gross immorality that has always characterized idolatry. Now, does that make sense to anybody? Now, when we look at Revelation chapter 17, I want to drop down into the text, if you would please, to verse number 8. Verse number 8. In verse 8, it begins what I'm convinced is a very difficult section. This is where we left off last time. And we left off with this part last time for a reason, because there's no way at the conclusion of a study in 2 or 3 minutes that we can talk about a passage that's very difficult. And if you'll note in verse 8, it says, "The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss and to go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wander, they whose name hath not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast, how that he was and is not and shall come. Here is the mind that hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth, and they are seven kings. The five are fallen, the one is, the other is not yet come, and when he cometh, he must continue for a little while. And the beast that was and is not is himself also an eighth, and is of the seven, and he goeth into perdition." Now, are you confused? I mentioned that these are some very difficult verses of Scripture, but there's some things that we need to remember. The language that is used here is not foreign to things that we've already talked about. For example, as you turn back into the book of Revelation to the 13th chapter and in verse 18, the 13th chapter and in verse 18, as the writer is discussing the mark of the beast. Now keep in mind, who is the beast? Well, we've got a beast in chapter 13 that came up out of the sea, and we've identified that as Rome, who was empowered by the dragon, and we've identified that as Satan. In fact, the text does that in chapter 12, verse 9. And then we've got a beast that came up out of the earth that had the authority to put to death those who would not worship the former beast, that is, the empire, or the emperor, or Rome. And we find in verse 18 of the 13th chapter, "Here is wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. How many of you have heard that? How many of you, when you're studying or talking with somebody, they talk about the mark of the beast? Oh, this is a terrible thing. And they set forth this 666 as the mark of the beast and become excited about that. And I think sometimes we become so focused on that, we forget that that's not the only mark that's identified in this text, for the writer sees yet another mark. And it is the mark of the Lamb and the mark of the Father written upon the heads of those who are faithful in the 14th chapter, beginning in verse 1. But the point I want to emphasize is this. In our text here, in chapter 17, verse 9, here is the mind that hath wisdom. John's already said that. In chapter 13, verse 18, "Here is wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast." Now, there are those who say, well, this is a mathematical equation that's equated to the use of certain Latin numbers that are letters, and they're translated and so forth. And so this number represents a particular man's name. And in order to do that, we've got to do some mental gymnastics to make that happen. But some say, well, this must be Nero. I don't know that it is. Some say, well, if you don't think it's Nero, then you must think that it's Domitian. I don't think that it's any particular man. But the concept that is expressed in this passage is that anybody who worships a man, you're doomed. Period. You become the subject of the wrath of God. Period. Now that's the point I think that's being established in this passage, because anything short of seven is not seven. Seven is the perfect, complete number in the book of Revelation. Six is not, and you times that by three, it's still not. In fact, it makes it emphatic that it's not, and it will never be complete. And so, an appeal then is justifiably made to the use of numbers in a symbolic way in the book of Revelation, which we've already established. We established that as we started this study in Revelation chapter 1, that it's addressed in verse 11 to the seven churches of Asia Minor. Well, how many churches were there in Asia Minor? Only seven? Well, no. No, we know there were more than seven churches in Asia Minor. Then what does the number seven indicate? Completeness. Perfection, if you please. So the letter that is written called Revelation, written to the seven churches of Asia Minor, is written in a way to help all understand that these elements are important to you, no matter who you are, no matter in what generation you live. But in this generation, they were facing Roman persecution even unto death. And so here we go. Now he that hath the mind, hath the mind that hath wisdom. Then he begins to elaborate on what this image means. Turn back to the 17th chapter. And look with me in verse 9 once again. The writer describes seven heads and seven mountains. Some say, well, the number seven then has to mean just an absolute seven. And the seven mountains likewise has to mean seven, because Rome was built on seven hills. Well, Rome may have been built on seven hills. That part is true. But I'm not persuaded that the number seven is indicative of Rome because of that. The Latin literature is replete with references to Rome being built on seven hills. That's not debatable. In fact, if you're reading from the English Standard Translation, I think that some of you are, if you drop down into that text to verses 9 through 10, it tells us that the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings. Now, what are the seven mountains? The writer tells us. He's not talking about geography. He's talking about the kings. Somebody said, well, wait a minute. These seven kings, we've got to go back and identify what kings these are. And so we play that, I almost said foolishness, and I think sometimes that's what it is. Because we're determined that we've got to be able to call the man's name of who these kings are. And any effort that I have ever read where that was attempted to be done has met in confusion. It's not conclusive. You can't go back and count the seven kings and everybody come out at the same place. Just hasn't happened. So how is the number seven used? How was it used regarding the seven churches of Asia Minor? It was used to indicate wholeness or completeness. And I would suggest to you that that's how it's used here. He's not specifically identifying a particular sequence of kings that you can call their names. But he is identifying the completeness, the wholeness of the emperors of Rome. Because the kings represent kingdoms. And as we read in verse 10, they are the seven kings. Five are fallen. One is. Another is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue for a little while. And the beast that was and is not is himself also an eighth and is of the seven. And he goeth unto perdition. And note what he said. And try not to be confused. He said there's seven. Wholeness, completeness. But there's going to be an eighth. But he's going to be one of the seven. Now what is it that characterized all of them? The evil, the corruptness of the empire characterized all of them. Now without at this point trying to identify the names of the kings, what did John say is going to happen to all of this? He said, it goeth unto perdition. It's going to fail. Now, if you try to become so bogged down in naming the kings and you miss the point that Rome will fail, anybody who opposes Christ will fail, then you've missed the point of the book. Just down the street here at the apartment complex, had a Bible study with a gentleman who years and years ago was the manager. I don't know if he's still alive or still doing it. But he had a notebook where he had tried to identify the kings of the earth that he thought that the Bible identified. And he had done an untold amount of research trying to identify the names of kings. And he had gone so far, he'd met himself coming back. Just had a mess. And he had missed the whole point that's being established here in the book of Revelation. And that is that no matter who it is that opposes God, you're not going to win. Now we saw that in the 11th chapter already. Now we see why. You see, what is John being told by this angel? Is the angel referring to the kingdoms of men that reigned as world empires? I think so. I think so. Should we counter or continue rather to follow the meaning of the numbers and symbols as they have been used so far? I think so. I don't believe that this now all of a sudden we're talking about something that's literal, seven literal kings. So then what do we want to think about? Well, we want to think about what the text says. Seven kings. Now, this is just a statement that I happen to agree with. A brief look at various commentaries show how difficult it is to know which emperor to begin and which ones to count. Now, you can go back and you can read this in almost any commentary, and if you want to do that. But the question is, does the list begin with Julius Caesar or with Augustus as we look at the Roman kings? Or does it begin with the first emperor to be hated and feared by the Jews and Christians, either Gaius, known as Caligula, or does it begin with Nero? Another question is, what should be done with the three emperors, Galba and Otho and Vitellius, who reigned within the single year, 68 to 69? Should they be counted separately or completely ignored or lump them together and count them as one? Now, if you're familiar at all with Roman history, you see the problems involved in this. Seven kings, yes. Seven kings, one commentator tells us, are a symbolic number representative of the whole series of empires, or emperors rather, and they would remain seven no matter how long the actual list happened to be. I think he's got a point. Because we're not counting men's names, but we're counting those who reigned in the empire. Now, what do we do with these lists? Well, notice this. To start with, consider the meaning of the number seven. Throughout Revelation, this number consistently has a symbolic reference to that which is complete and whole. It is the perfect divine number, since seven represents the whole, five is broken, incomplete number. This suggests that the total number of kings who have been and shall be, the greater part is come and gone. One refers to the current reigning power, and the seventh king is yet to reign, and that only for a brief time. Now that's from Parkwriter's material in his commentary. I think he's got that pretty close to right, because we're not trying to identify names. Now here's where the problem ensues. I've only listed four commentators on this particular passage of Scripture. And notice, if you will, that it seems to be the real big problem is where to start numbering. Those of you who are familiar with Roman history, was Julius Caesar the first emperor? Well, no, he was not the first emperor. Some say, well, we've got to count him because he was almost an emperor. Well, if you'll note, during the days of Julius Caesar, Rome was a republic. And Julius Caesar did not always concur with that which the Republic wanted to do. And he never reached the status of being a king. But you see, this all begins to fall apart if we don't start with him as king. But he wasn't a king. Now, most commentaries start with Augustus as the first legitimate king. But you do the counting and see where you wind up. When you begin to start with a man's name, you come up with all kinds of conclusions, don't you? Because there's not a consistent formula that you can plug into this and say, well, this is this king, this is that king, and we've got this nailed down exactly. No. No. But when you come to the conclusion that the number 7 is used consistently in the book of Revelation, that we're not looking to identify a sequence of 7 kings, then it begins to make a little bit more sense. But here's the approach that some make. They say, well, 5 have fallen, and we start with Augustus. And here's the list of those who have fallen. Now, when you do that, you see that you wind up with Nero being at the tail end of that list. And then we've got to do some more examining. One is, well, now wait a minute, here are 3 that reigned within a period of less than 2 years. Some say only 1 year. And so we're going to lump them together and count them as 1. All right, well, were they 1 or were they 3? He said 1 is not yet come. Some say, well, that has to be Vespasian. And then his son Titus, who reigned for a short time. And then that brings us to the beast that was, and he is not, and he himself is also the 8th. And so that must be then Domitian. I'm not convinced by any of this, as far as evidence is concerned. They said he's 1 of the 7. The point I want us to see is that the kingdoms of men are not invincible. The kingdoms of men fall, and Daniel told King Nebuchadnezzar that. From the get-go, these kings and their kingdoms would fall. And Mr. Nebuchadnezzar, that includes you. That includes the king of the Medes and the Persians. That kingdom would not last. And then the Greek Empire, established by Alexander the Great, it would not last. For Rome would destroy it and be a powerful kingdom, but within Rome, there would begin to show the weakness of iron and clay. Remember that from Daniel 2? And Daniel said, it shall be a broken kingdom. And what would ultimately happen to the Roman kingdom? It too would fall. But in the days of the Roman kings, God would set up one that would not fall. And we know that to be the kingdom of Christ. And we know that it would break in pieces and consume all kingdoms. Citizens from Babylon and all these other kingdoms that Daniel has named all over would become a part of the Lord's kingdom. And wasn't that what Isaiah prophesied in Isaiah chapter 2 when he talked about how that the Lord's house would be established on the top of the mountains and all nations would flow into it? And we see then in Acts chapter 2 that beginning to come to pass with the establishment of the Lord's church. And when did it occur? During the days of the Roman kings. Now, my friend, I know I've gone through that quickly, and I don't have all the answers. If we want to take a literalistic interpretation of Revelation chapter 17 and identify by name these kings. But I do want to note, as the thought process continues in verse 12, it says, and the 10 horns that thou sawest are 10 kings, who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. Now again, we've used the number 10 to indicate power in the book of Revelation. Not necessarily identifying 10 specific kings. Haven't been all that long ago till I tried to talk to somebody, said he had the names of all these 10 kings. Knows exactly who they are. No, no you don't. I don't believe that you could find any kind of universal opinion of who these 10 kings are. efforts to do that just meets with confusion. But what we do know is that they received authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. Now, is he talking about a literal 60 minutes, or is he talking about a limited period of time? Well, we've noted that this short time is noted a number of times in the book of Revelation. But here were some who would receive authority as kings with the beast for a short period of time. And then what? Look at verse 13. These have one mind, and they give their power and authority unto the beast. These kings that are being identified in this passage, whoever they are, they become subsidiaries of the Roman Empire, or king, as it were. And as subsidiaries, we're going to see that they served only for a short time. And they became disenchanted with their relationship with Rome. And they began to withhold their influence and their power from Rome. Now, what's happening to Rome? Well, we've noted that Daniel said that Rome would be partly strong and partly broken. It would be composed of iron and clay mixed together. And within the weakness of that fourth empire, it would ultimately fall apart. And we're going to see that in the 18th chapter. And then on into the 19th chapter. Now, this beast had horns. 10 horns. Consistently, we've noted that horns generally indicate in Old Testament text of apocalyptic language, which we have here, indicates power and strength. And these had not yet received kingdoms, as it were. These were to become what we've called vassal kings, as it, that is, put into power by Rome, who was the real power. But they became nothing more than puppets to Rome. Now, when you come into the New Testament, you read of such characters. You read of Herod. And you see Herod's corruptness when you begin to read in texts such as Acts 26 and Agrippa in Acts 26. Another Herod in Acts chapter 12. Puppets of Rome, that's all they were. And you also note that these conquered kings and rulers of countries, and they were dependent upon Rome, because they were vassals of Rome. But then they became disenchanted, and they began to rebel. But at this point, they had one mind. That is, obey Rome. Be a good, faithful subject. You'd think politics has just originated, brethren. Politics existed in New Testament times. Now, when we look at the context of this, we begin to arrive at the thing that John is trying to tell us in this whole book. If you don't learn anything from this study, I hope that you can learn verse 14 of this text. Because I'm convinced that verse 14 is the theme, just stated, the theme of the whole book. And the text tells us, these shall war against the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. For He is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they also shall overcome that are with Him, called and chosen and faithful. My friend, that's powerful. These shall war against the Lamb, but they won't win. Who will? The Lamb will win. And those who overcome with the Lamb, those who are called, chosen, and faithful. Now, who is that? Well, that's Christians. That's Christians. Now, what could Rome do? We've already studied that Rome, through its subsidiaries, could take your life. They could persecute you even unto death. And we saw one of the churches of Asia Minor in chapter 2 identified. Be faithful unto death, verse 10. I will give you the crown of life. That's the very worst thing they can do to you. They can kill you. But now what are you going to do if they do? You will reign with Christ. The called, the chosen, and the faithful. Now I want you to be impressed with that. You see, this one verse defines the whole message of this apocalyptic book, the book of Revelation. And it helps us to see who Jesus is. The Lamb will overcome. And you follow with the Lamb, you'll overcome too. Now, does that get your attention? It may cost you your life, but it won't cost you your soul. Be faithful. Serve the Lord. And you'll receive then the ultimate reward. He will overcome, and you will overcome with Him. Now, what about the rest? Let's go back to the 12th chapter and pick up there at verse 7. Back in the 12th chapter, where this war between good and evil begins to be discussed. In verse 7, look again. It says, "And there was war in heaven, Michael and his angels going forth to war with the dragon. And the dragon warred and his angels, and they prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he that is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him. And I heard a great voice in heaven saying, Now is come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, who accuseth them before our God day and night, and they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb, and because of the word of their testimony. And they loved not their life even unto death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and ye that dwell in them. For the earth and the sea, because the devil is gone down unto you, having great wrath, knowing that he hath but a short time." 5 minutes, okay. Now, does that impress you? To know that if you worship and serve the Lord, there's not any power on the top side of God's green earth that can overthrow you. Not anything. Not even the devil. Not even those who worship and serve the devil can't overthrow you. You know why? Familiar passage to you. Jesus said before he ascended to the right hand of God, "God has given me all power, all authority in heaven and on earth." And what about those who ally themselves with Rome? Well, they're not going to survive. They'll not survive. You know why? Because he is Lord of lords and he is King of kings. Now you can't do anything about that. And we started with that in Revelation chapter 1. If you'll drop down in that text to verse 5. In verse 5 it says, "And from Jesus," well, begin the thought at verse 4. "John to the seven churches that are in Asia. Grace to you and peace from him who is and who was and who is to come. And from the seven spirits that are before the throne. And from Jesus Christ, who is the faithful witness and firstborn from the dead, and the ruler of the kings of the earth, unto him that loveth us and loosed us from our sins by his blood." What did Jesus do for you? Well, he became King of kings and Lord of lords. You see Paul emphasizing that in Ephesians chapter 1, verses 20 through verse 23, as he talks about the place that Jesus has after the resurrection. He's seated at the right hand of God, and there's given him power and dominion and glory and so forth. He's head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him that filleth all in all. Now, at this point, I want to try to get in. How much time do I have?
3 minutes.
3 minutes. I want to get this in before we close. All who are with the Lamb will be victorious and will share in his victory. Now, I made the point a few moments ago that when Jesus was crucified, you might say, well, Satan had a heyday because he's finally overcome and defeated the cause of Christ. Oh, no, he didn't. Because we know 3 days later, just as Jesus had said and just as the prophets had said, Jesus was raised from the dead, and indeed the gates of Hades would not prevail against him. But I think sometimes in our reading of the Old Testament prophet Isaiah, we miss this point in verse 12, and I want to call your attention to it. We often read this whole chapter when we're about to partake of the Lord's Supper, and when we're trying to discuss the things that were prophesied about the coming of Jesus and what he would do on our behalf. And we note, verse 6, that Jehovah hath laid on him the iniquity of us all. and so forth. But I want to pick up the reading beginning at verse 10 and emphasize verse 12. Isaiah 53, verse 10. Yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him, and hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. He shall see of the travail of his soul, and shall be satisfied. By the knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. Because he poured out his soul unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bare the sin of many and made intercession for their transgressors. Now, when you look at the first part of verse 12, when one overcomes an enemy, it was common occurrence for the victor to take the spoils from the enemy. What did he do with them? He put them into his own treasury, didn't he? Increased the power and might of his empire by taking the spoils of his enemies and putting them into his own treasury. What did Jesus do? It tells us, therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. What does Jesus do with the spoils? He shares them with you. Because his victory is over sin. And what you get is forgiveness. Now, is that in our text? I believe it is. Those who war with the Lamb will lose. Who becomes the beneficiary? Well, the sinner becomes the beneficiary because he enjoys forgiveness. And we'll have to start with that next time. Thank you for your kind attention in our study.